Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
We'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History of Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. We're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at Gridiron Greats Magazine. .com. At this time, I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Chesper. Welcome to the show.
Bob, so great to be back. I'm excited. I'm excited. It's been a couple of weeks since we've had a show. It's great to be back.
We're back, and we're getting into some heavy duty business on what we're going to talk about tonight. And before we get into our special topic, we've got a few tidbits to look at. First of all, congratulations goes out to the Chicago/St. Louis/Los Angeles/New Los Angeles Rams football team for winning Super Bowl, the 56th Super Bowl I've actually watched on TV since I was a wee toddler.
Oh.
And also just one general comment I was going to make, and I will make it. I knew from the start the Rams were predestined to win the Super Bowl somehow, somewhere,
yeah,
in the last 2 minutes of the game, and my prediction came true. But anyways,
yeah,
it was a pretty good game. Pretty good game. And I believe,
yeah, they kind of had that swagger this year.
Definitely. I'm a big fan of head coach Zach Taylor, because
yeah,
he has a great pedigree to him. His father-in-law is Mike,
yep,
Sherman, the former head coach of the Green Bay Packers, a individual who played football for Central Connecticut State College at the time, At the same time, I was attending and covering games for Southern Connecticut State College, which was in New Haven, Connecticut. He was in New Britain, Connecticut. Many years later, I wrote to him when he became a Packer coach. I did mention our very, very limited connection, knowing darn well he had no clue who I was. But he did say he did remember playing Southern during his college career. He was actually a very good college player, and he had, in my opinion, a lot of different types of success over the years in his coaching career. He apparently retired to Cape Cod, and he coached the high school football team there for several years. And I believe, if I am correct in my assumption, he's 66 or 67 now. He's several years older than me. But good guy. And I was happy for Zach. I said this to a few people after the game, that Taylor was pretty much totally emotionless on the side of the field, on his side of the field. And to me, the essence of a good coach is someone who, in a lot of ways, doesn't show emotion, doesn't berate players, so on and so forth. And I think he'll win the big one down the road. I think he's got a great career in front of him. That's my
absolutely
my opinion of the game.
The Bengals won some really, really tough away games. I mean, when you're beating Kansas City, Patrick Mahomes at home, you know, who just came off winning one of the greatest, you know, playoff games we've ever seen against the Buffalo Bills. I mean, maybe the Kansas City Chiefs spent all the energy they had wrapping up the Bills and, you know, thought the Bengals would be a cakewalk, but they underestimated us. I mean,
yep.
Tip of the hat to the Bengals. They won a very tough away game. So did the Rams. I mean,
yep.
You know, it wasn't an easy trek for either of these teams. And I've always dug, you know, wild card teams, you know, or just, you know, teams who have to battle through the divisional rounds, don't get the byes. Neither of these teams got the bye. The number one seed in, you know, both conferences got bounced. And interesting. But man, the Rams had some swagger. It's good to see Aaron Donald win a ring. Good to see Matthew Stafford win a ring. There's certain people who deserve a ring, you know.
Right. Stafford, I really believe, is a class act. He's a good guy. He's good for the community. He did a lot in Detroit, in the Detroit community while he was there. He never gave up on the Lions, and I really believe, I know I said this on the show over the years, way back when, if he was on a better team, I really think he could go all the way and win, and it's been proven because he's a good quarterback, under pressure. He had some really good receivers he was working with the Rams, and he showed what he could do, and that was a good thing. That's a good thing. And Detroit, unfortunately, is still Detroit. It's just a mess over there. They just can't get their act together. It's amazing, truly amazing.
Yeah.
You know, to go over almost 70 years of victories, and what's it, 30 years since been in the playoffs. I mean, come on. It's pathetic. It really is. You know? But anyway.
There are some teams that can't seem to – I thought the Browns were going to do the good this year. I don't know. There's just some teams that can't get it together.
Yep.
I thought the Seahawks were that team for a long time because it had just I mean, flashes of greatness. 2005 Seahawks loss in a Super Bowl to the Steelers. I would call it referee game. Ref gate. I don't know. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just realize how hard it is to get there. I mean, just that is a climb to make it to the Super Bowl. You know, it is hard enough to win one. I mean, to win in free agency, you have to win in contracts, you have salary caps, you have injuries, everything that it takes to get there. One injury of a quarterback somewhere during the playoff run, and it doesn't matter how good your team was, you're hitting the reset button.
That's why it's critical in the NFL today. And I've been saying this for a long time. Your backup quarterback, you need to go back to the Unitas Earl Morrill setup or the Mark Starr Zeke Gronkowski setup where your number two quarterback doesn't look delusional when he walks on the field and just staring at the coach to try to get the play calls. You need to walk in with confidence, and you need to take over the team, and you need to continue the drive or whatever is going on, and you need to win the game. It's simple. And there's not enough emphasis, in my opinion, with the exception of a couple teams only, that the number two quarterback can walk on a field, take over a game, and win a game for a team, unlike not being patterned whatsoever by Unitas Morrill, for example, or the I use Star Bratkowski. You know, there's several others down the over the years, but it's just not there today. I really don't see it. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I just don't see it. You know, I don't have a lot of confidence when Jordan Love goes on the field if Rodgers goes down, and I have even less confidence now if Rodgers leaves, and he takes over the number one spot. We are, you know, we're going to be stepping back in time there, you know. So
yeah,
it'd be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah. Think about the GM of the Rams who made that trade to bring Stafford in, you know, bring in Odell Beckham Jr. Drafting, you know, to get cut. I mean, just, you know, what they gave away to get Stafford. And if you, you know, and the old, you know, they do that to win a Super Bowl. Anything less than that,
yep.
And there's a possibility some heads are on the chopping block because you give away a couple first-round draft choices and that. I mean, that's a gamble, and it's a gamble that paid off. So I like it.
Yep. Exactly. And if Rodgers comes back for 1 year, my biggest fear is there's going to be a huge giveaway in Green Bay to supposedly give him everything he needs and our coach there everything he needs to win the Super Bowl, because there will definitely be if Rodgers plays his last season. But I use the example, I talked about this before, deer in the headlights look. Mike McCarthy was well known for the deer in the headlights look at a game where it seems like he lost touch with what was going on the field. And I saw it with the last game, looking at what was going on with special teams, looking what was going on with Rodgers, who just looked totally disinterested on the field, that he didn't want to be there. But to have your special teams fail in the biggest game of the year you're playing, that's no excuse. Okay, so now you're actually spending money for assistant coaches again because you realize you blew a chance to go to the Super Bowl with your last game because you're young up-and-coming guy to be your special teams coach because you don't want to pay him any money. Well, it cost you. You know what I mean? So, I'm seeing on the Green Bay sideline, I hate to say it, that deer in the headlight look and the, gosh, gee, what did I do wrong? Why is nothing clicking? You know? Man, oh, man, I could have called a better game than what he called for crying out.
That's got to be aggravating. I remember there's a couple times that, you know, watching McCarthy, you know, just on the sidelines, just as everything's falling apart, just kind of standing there.
Yeah.
And I remember I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know, get riled up, get excited. And I'm like, that's got to be aggravating as a, you know, as a super fan like you are, where it's just, you know, I want to see my superstar on the sideline. It's kind of like when, you know, a quarterback throws an interception, then goes over to the sideline and sits there and looks at the, you know, Microsoft pad. You know what?
Yeah.
You know, I want the quarterback on the sideline. You come on, guys. You're rooting on his defense. You know,
yeah.
I want him to be the biggest cheerleader, you know, of the other side.
Yeah.
You know, slapping butts as they're coming off the sidelines. Nice job. You know, just whatever. I mean, I think that pumps people up, and I think it whittles down from the coach as well. I wasn't a fan when Pete Carroll got hired as the head coach of the Seahawks, but I got to say that guy is excitable. He's excitable. He pumps up the players.
To me, LaFleur is trying to be too, in a way, his youth is an advantage and a disadvantage in a way, because to me, that last game was, and every playoff game literally he's been in, he's made a lot of serious mistakes coaching. And, okay, you're a great regular season coach, but you're not going to take it to the next level that's the way you're always going to be known. You know what I mean? And if the Packers weren't a publicly owned team and they didn't have the conglomerate to make the decisions as far as coaching and stuff, I got a feeling he would be, you know, called in the office after the game the next day and say, listen, next year it's all or nothing, or you're out of here. Not to put the pressure on you, but we're not going to accept it like that, you know. But is what it is, and that's it. You know, nothing I can do about it. And I find great irony we're talking about it because this is the actual first show from the new compound here in Southport, North Carolina.
I'm in my
quasi non-decorated man cave up here. I have all my furniture on order. I have one bookcase that came in, so I got the run out. I gotta take a picture of it and send it out. But I have I'm looking at right now over 1,000 media guides, hard and soft cover books, publications, programs, Packers stuff galore, sitting on the floor on chairs and the like. And I have a little closet room, which is literally filled with cards everywhere. And the one thing I felt good the past, that we're in, this is going on our third week we're in the house, and it's taken me a good 2 weeks just to unpack my stuff. It was so nice seeing those stuff again. And again, jogging my memory of stuff I even forgot I had type of thing. So it's been a nice transition down here to get in. I'll be happy though when the two major bookcases get delivered and get put up, and I can get my stuff on the wall again and a lot of that stuff put away. So
it's got to be cool to finally, and it's so, to me, it's so therapeutic to you know, unpack that stuff. I love going downstairs my you know man cave, just kind of, you know, sifting through it every once in a while. It's got to be cool because you've got a chance to sift through it. You got a chance to sift through it before leaving Wallingford, and now here you have another chance to sift through and organize, you know, in the new compound.
Yeah, and it's, to me, the stuff I got rid of back in Connecticut was I mean, I know I basically got rid of well over 500 publications while I was in Wallingford packing because I didn't want to take it down, and they were not football related. And so I got a buddy of mine there who deals on the, he's a dealer on the side, and I gave them to him, and like, he was just in shock to see what I had. He couldn't believe how much stuff I had accumulated over the years because he really didn't see the depth of it. But, you know, I always said I wanted to establish a nice football library, which is what I have here. And I just want to be football only, with the exception of the handful of baseball items that I have from games I attended over the years and family and friends, if they were playing or whatever type of thing. But it's nice to go through everything. And speaking of that, we got the new issue out, issue 75 of Gridiron Greats Magazine. Got a lot of nice compliments from individuals on it. I got to say Jared Krause did a great job on the front cover. It's a really cool cover. And
I love me some Jared Krause. He is not only a nice guy, but a great artist.
Yeah, incredible stuff. He's actually hand-drawn a lot of stuff for me, which I have in frames of Packer players. And he did a nice poster of Forrest Gregg, and he had Coach sign it to me before he passed away. So that's a real nice piece I gotta hang up here. But it was a good issue. I was happy with it, and literally for the next
when I was a super collector, Jared sketched Steve Largent, you know, for the cover. And then he mailed me the painting that he'd done for it, and it hangs proudly in my office, my Jared Krause original. Two really good articles in the 75. Congratulations, Bob, by the way. I don't think a lot of people, you know, give you the credit you deserve being the publisher of Gridiron Greats, but that is the hobby magazine. I love it. It's always exciting to get it. And I loved the design, and I really liked looking at the at the covers that were behind the silhouette of the 75 on the front. And that was a trip down memory lane. I sent it to you, but definitely, like a year ago during the pandemic, I went and cataloged every single Gridiron Great and and then, you know, put notes about what articles were in there. I think I sent that Excel spreadsheet to you, but because there's times I'm like, oh, I remember that article. What episode or, you know, what magazine is that in? It was funny, but two really good articles in here. Your super collector, Michael Mason Balder. I love his Maseum. That was really cool. I love seeing passionate collectors. And then the Heisman ballot. I really loved Kerry Lavin, you know, his pre-Heisman. Who would have won? And I like seeing a nod to, you know, to Red Grange getting it. He thinks he would have won in 23 and 24. I don't know about 23, but I'm pretty sure 24 would have been him. I would agree with that. But just really cool the way he broke that down and good thought process. Loved it.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, I hope one day when everything settles down, I can make the infamous West Coast trip, Mike Blaisdell up in Washington, then you down in Oregon, and then see the niece in California, and then hit the museum and hit Tobias, and hopefully all worth for lunch, and then head back home. So I'm hoping over the next couple of years things settle down and we can get out there, so that'll be cool. But, you know, to me, every issue, you know, looking at these super collectors is just like, it's just like walking into a museum. I mean, to look at this stuff, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
It's really incredible.
Yeah.
It's so nice to view, and I've been very, very fortunate and blessed over the years to actually see in person some collections that to me are Hall of Fame worthy. You know, they're like their own Hall of Fame they go to every day, just walking into their man cave, museum, so on and so forth. It just amazes me, truly amazes me. The passion in this hobby, the football collecting card and memorabilia hobby, the passion that collectors have, I think, is well beyond, I'll go out on the limb, it's beyond any other sports collectible. That's my honest opinion. I know I'm going to get beat up by the baseball guys on it, but I just really feel it because it's a limited collectible. There's only X amount of games of a football season. It's not 162 games. It's not 154 games. It's basically, if you go all the way, it's going to be now 20 games. If not, in the old days, it was basically 16 games or 14 games or 13 games. But man, oh man, the passion that is exhibited and the completeness of some of these collections for teams that are relatively new, meaning AFL teams from 1960 on and so forth, it's just incredible. It's just truly incredible. Greg Trattner is an excellent example. The man is Buffalo Bills history. He is Buffalo Bills memorabilia and just an incredible, incredible collection. It's just one example of numerous examples I can give. It's just amazing, truly amazing to me. So thank you for the compliment. And as we speak, I'm basically putting the roughs together for issue 76. We got a big issue coming out in 76. A lot of articles, a lot of information. And my senior contributing writer, my co-host, I will not spill it yet, but has written a very, very informative, interesting, and dynamic piece on a very rare set, in my opinion, because I've never seen one in all the years of all the shows I've been to, and I realize it's more West Coast focused, but I've never seen one in person, so pretty cool. And I'll leave it at that.
And I forgot to tell you, and I forgot to mention in that, Bob, I need to give a an assist in that article and when you're doing the credits to Mike Blaisdell, because he sent me some of the notes he had on the article. I forgot to mention that when I emailed it off to you, but I liked it too. That was a long time coming. I'm working on another article right now. I'm sure it's like household projects, you know, around the house. I tend to start something and have a hard time wrapping up. But Kerry Lavin's not going to like this, but I'm working on an article called The Insignificance of the Heisman Trophy in Modern Times.
I hate to say it. I agree with you to a certain degree. The Heisman is just not like it used to be. That's for sure. So
not like it used to be.
But it is what it is. That's it.
And that's tonight, what I began to notice. So, oh well.
Tonight, Tonight we're gonna talk about something special tonight. It's been a conversation on VFC, and it's a topic of conversation with some hardcore football card and memorabilia collectors, and it's the infamous 1935 National Chickle set of 36 cards, and it's a set that I, in reviewing my notes, and since I'm happy I got old books and whatever, I'm looking right now at my Beckett big All-American, Sport Americana football, hockey, basketball, and boxing card price guide, number 6, which I still use. And I have my original notes on my 35 Chickle set, the first time I ever put it together. And I know I mentioned this before, back in June of 1988, in the Milford, Connecticut card show, I bought my first National Chickle, which was card number 7, Ken Strong from the Giants. And I graded it X near mint condition, and I paid, believe it or not, and I still distinctly remember, it was the most I ever paid for a card up until that point. I paid $25 for the card. And I had to justify it in my own. I had to justify it in my mind back then, 34 years ago, that it's an old card. It was the first time I ever saw a Chickle at a show, especially at a local show. And I said, I got to at least have one, and let me buy it, and let me, look at it, study it, and see what I'm going to do with it. So over the period up until, I believe it was 2016 or 18, I got to double check it. I started to put together the set and ended up selling what I had in the set 3 different occasions, the last time being my most advanced level of Chickles that I had, because I had some of the high numbers. I didn't and wasn't excited about some of the high numbers because they were graded. And being a purist, I said, I got to make a decision here, and I don't want to collect the high numbers in slabs. So let me just sell them off, and let me try to recollect it again one more time. So at this point right now, I'm leaning toward trying to just put together the 3 Packers in the set, which are cards 24, 32, and 33, 32 and 33 being high numbers, being very difficult to find. In all the times I put the set together, the only time I ever had one Packer card was card number 24, and that was the last time I had put it together, and it was basically in fair, good condition. And I my Ken Strong card over the years was actually the best graded card I ever had, and I sold that one very early on. I did make money on it because I did sell it for a whopping $60. So I did make.
What year was that?
$35 on that transaction. So, but anyway, so that's my background on the Chickles break set. And like I said, I think I'm just going to pursue 3 lesser grade Packer cards to put into my Packer collection and not be overly concerned about putting the whole set together, for the simple reason there was some incredible pricing, which I thought was going to go a lot higher, recently on a PSA graded number 1 Nagurski card. And Joe, I'll hand off to you now. Give us a little background on that card and what happened.
Just more recently on eBay, a PSA 1 Nagurski sold for the whopping price of $7,400. And 1 cent. I don't know where that 1 cent came from, but I loved that. I was cracking up as I saw that. But I think that's a record for a PSA 1. Very nice looking example. It's got some wrinkles on it. Looks like it was folded in half and then folded again into fourths. But none of the wrinkles break the surface. None of it detracts. If you take step back from about 3 feet, it looks good. It's centered. The corners look good.
Yep.
If this wasn't creased, this would be a PSA 6. So, I mean, it's a good-looking card. The pessimist in me says, very high price because somebody bought it to try and see if they could soak that out. But, once you fold the card in half like that, the cardboard's broken. That's not getting soaked out.
Right.
Beautiful. High Appeal, great example, $7,400.01. Don't forget the 1 cent, Captain. But a record.
And I thought,
if we're breaking,
I go well over 10,000, but I was mistaken. Oh, really? I was kind of surprised about that. Yeah, I really thought because it was affordable, and like you said, and I'm looking at it right now again. It is a nice looking card, you know, and you got some history with the card because you got all the creases in it. So it's pretty cool, in my opinion.
Yep.
But again, I think $7,400 is a good price for it. So that's good.
Yep, they're starting to get there. Love of the game, Al Crisafulli, who we had on the show a little while back. I consigned my PSA 2 Nagurski to him recently, or in his last auction, and it sold for $12,000. So you have a $7,400 and a $12,000. My PSA 2 was similar, very nicely centered, great quarters, had a little bit of surface loss under Bronco's, you know, right hand, his thumbs up as you're looking at it.
Right.
But you know, good looking card. I tried to get it bumped a few times. I took it to the National. I had Scott Alpaw put his discerning eye to it. He looked at it and said, PSA 2 max. And I said, okay, won't even bother submitting this. And I walked it over to Al and said, please put this in your next auction. So, So I am currently Nagurski-less, if that's a word, Bob. So I need to get me a Bronco. Yeah.
While we're talking about the Chickles, you also need some uncut sheets from the 35 Chickles set for your collection.
Oh.
So we're gonna put that out again. If anyone has it or knows someone who wants to sell it, contact either Joe or me, or contact me through the magazine, and we'll coordinate everything for you, and we'll help you with the sale. So,
Bob,
but anyway,
you're a gentleman. I appreciate the I appreciate the plug. You are a gentleman, sir. Chickles. I just this is the 35 Chickle was the first. And I'm doing some air quotes here. It was the first nationally released set to only have football players. Okay, so we have Pottsville Maroons, but that was a regional. And it's a postcard. We've got the Mayo set that was college. So this is a nationally released set to have professional football players. You can throw in. I mean, there's a lot of little set. Rogers, Pete, et cetera. I mean, but those were sets that had all players in them. This is football only. Nationally released set. There was, by the National Chickle Company, who's out of Cambridge, Mass. If you flip the cards over, there's a description where it's the National Chickle Company, Cambridge, Mass, U.S. of A., which I have always loved. But it contains 36 cards, even though on the flippo, on the back side of it, it says one of 240 players with playing tips. They stopped at 36, and that is the mystery that will remain forever. Was that a lost leader to keep kids buying these, or did they intend to put out 240 players and it wasn't well received, and they stopped at 36? Who knows? I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we talked about this a couple times in the past. Number one, we're in the Depression. The signs of war for World War II were beginning in Europe. So it could have been an economic decision on the part of the National Chickle Company to say, okay, like you said and we said in the past, it wasn't well received as far as being purchased in the stores. So they said they decided to stop it. Could have been marketing to try to get people to buy more? Well, yes and no, because after a while, if you're getting all the same cards, 1 to 24 all the time, there's no
That's
way
the
you're
going
to get 240. Or could it have been a typo, would have been one of 24 cards in the set. And I always thought about this. they made a typo and they just kept the typo and nobody checked it? And or were there actually 240 players that were going to sign contracts to get their image to do the cards with? That's kind of a push too. I mean, about it. You know, 1935, unless you added college players, you really had a tough time coming up with, you know, I mean, I could take a handful of people that should have, you know, been in the set, Grange being one of them. I don't know what the mystery, you know, how the mystery can be solved other than it's a combination of factors, it's a typo, who knows? You know, unfortunately, we'll never know what the real answer is.
Grange retired. And just a little bit of math here. You know, at the time, you know, the 35 Chicle was set up, there were only 8 NFL teams. You know, so 240 divided by 8 would be 30 players per NFL franchise. So, Doug Spanning,
you would be hard pressed to get 30 actual different players from each team, you know, and then you would have all the college people. So.
Yeah, Doug Spanning had done an article on the Eddie Casey signatures and the variations in the back. And in there, he touched on that same thing that I was thinking, you know, because, you know, when I was digging into this, you know, for today's show, it's like, well, how many teams, how many players? And he found the same. There were 31 players on the Packers in 1935. So most teams had between 30 and 35 players. So you'd be talking about every single player on all 8 NFL teams getting a 35 Chicle card. So there's only 2 players who aren't pros in this. If we're running down the checklist, Newt Rockne, obviously a college coach, popular. He's the only college player. The Bronco Nagurski, oddly enough, has him in a Minnesota with a Minnesota banner in the back. But it mentions that he's a Chicago player on the obverse, on the flip side. So obviously obviously he was a professional at the time. He was playing for the Bears, but it's kind of interesting that they have the Minnesota banner. Other than that, these are all professionals. Pretty interesting. In other words, I think the 240 was a ploy to get people to chase a checklist maybe they were going to come out with another 36, but they would have been very hard pressed to find more stars, especially professionals. But I mean, who would have made the next series? I mean, you have 1 through 36. I mean, half these players were flashes in the pan. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of Hall of Famers in here, obviously, but, you know, they also misspelled quite a bit. I think there's 3 misspellings, but, who would have been the next? Number 37 through 240, you know?
I would have to say Grange, without a doubt, if they wanted some star draw. And, you know, after that, to me, it's going to be mostly college players. You know, that's the way I look at it, because there really weren't that many, you know, unless you really studied football history, you really don't know the players on the rosters of the mid-30s in football. For example, if you look at the 3 Packer players, they're not overly well-known as far as, unless you're a hardcore Packer fan, you don't even realize these guys played on the team, type of thing. So I don't, I really don't have good examples of who I would actually use at that time, with the exception of Grange, and maybe some earlier stars of the late 20s, early 30s.
Yep.
And bringing them on and trying to fall them on. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. Who have you come up with, if anybody? Because
When John Spano and I did an article on the 35 Chicle set years ago for Gridiron Greats, a couple of the people that I chose, number one, Don Hudson. He would have been there. He was playing at the time, just barely, but You know, Don Hudson, you know, Packer, great. Johnny Blood, you know, would have probably made it. And exactly what you said, Red Grange, likely. You know, and at some point they would have had to take the, you know, almost like you mentioned, they would have had to have taken the, you know, the, you know, the 55 tops All-American, you know, stance where they're, you know, where they would, you know, where they, you know, go back for college players, I think. But, yeah, Don Hudson, and for that article, I had a friend of mine who, you know, is, you know, a designer. I had him create what that, what those 35 chickles would have looked like. So if you go back to that Gridiron Great, you know, magazine, you'll see what my, you know, fictitious, you know, what my fictitious Johnny Blood McNally and Don Hudson card would have looked like. I'm looking at them right now. It's pretty good. I made them both PSA 8. I didn't change the cert number. So if you look that cert number up, it'll be something else, but, but looking at it, they turned out pretty good. I use the All-American, you know, the very well-known photo. That I'll share those with you later, but I loved it. But
another college player you could have thrown out, although well past his playing time, Albie Boos, you know, from Yale. I'm going through my 55 All-American set, looking at it right now, trying to see if I can come up with some people. Still have the Four Horsemen as an individual card, or you could do four separate cards of them and try to stretch it out that way. You're really pulling for stuff here. You know, that's what it comes down to.
Really interesting.
How about Alonzo Stagg, head coach?
Wow.
Another one.
Good point.
So you're really pushing one way or the other. And, again, it's a classic situation where, you know, we could surmise anything we want. We still will not, you know, unfortunately, unless we find somebody who's actually there and or descendant of, and they have some paperwork on it, we'll never know the real reason what happened. I think the big reason
How it was issued. I really want to see a sheet. It's kind of like with the 57 tops. People thought it was issued in two series. And once you look at the sheet, you realize it wasn't issued in two series. Just anything over number 110 in the 57 tops was a single print, where the other stuff was double printed. Excuse me. And this is the same way. You begin to think this was, you know, issued like 1 through 24 were double prints on the card, and then 25 up were singles. Because you can literally draw a Maginot line after Clark Hinkle, number 24. Clark Hinkle is a pop 18 in PSA 8, and then you cross over into what I call the second series, or second one-third, and Dale Burnett is a PSA 8, or is a pop 8 in PSA 8. You know, Dutch Clark is a pop 19. The rarest card in 1 through 24 is Ed Matizic, which is a pop 9.
Right.
PSA 10 in this is card number 8, Jim Zintel. Imagine what a PSA 10 35 chickle looks like. That's pretty cool. But Cliff Battles, pop 29 in PSA 8. Phil Sorbo, pop 28 in PSA 8. Tom Jones, pop 32. Mike Mukilak, pop 31. These are very in high quality, you know, in the 20s and 30s. And then you cross into card number 25. You've got 1 through 24, and then you've got, you know, 25 to 36, you know, the second, third. And it's pop 8, pop 10. The Bull Tosi card, which is the rarest card, card number 27 is a pop 5 in a PSA 8, and for the longest time it was a pop 4. So somebody just got a fifth PSA 8 in there. We don't have to go very far down. Even the Nagurski, the Nagurski, there are six PSA 8s, and it's been six PSA 8s for the last decade.
Right.
You know, Yeah, just so, I mean, I would love, I get the feeling the sheet was, you know, 1 through 24 and then 25 to 36. So the, you know, so you had, you know, the two-thirds of the sheet were double prints, you know,
right,
and
right.
Then the third of the sheet was whatever. That's it. But I mean, I that's why I want to, I love these mysteries, and that's why I want to see a sheet. So, I mean, but to
well,
me,
we,
to
I
me,
remember,
that,
what, I remember one show we were talking about. I speculated, I'm looking back at my notes now, I speculated, do you think they put on the sheet itself the 1 to 24 and then put cards from some other non-sports set or whatever on the same sheet? Would have that been possible? Who knows? You know,
yes.
That's another thing that that could have happened. They had a they had a non-sports set that they needed a final series on or whatever, and they threw it on the sheet, or they mixed it up on the sheet, one or the other.
That's possible. And we know it was printed in various runs because there are four variations to the Eddie Casey signature on the back.
Right.
So I mean, so they changed the print type on it four times. So you had your various print runs, and the four variations. Doug Spanning, who I used to talk to a lot, did a really in-depth write-up on this, and he came up with the four variations, which is Eddie Casey's signature centered, Eddie Casey's signature at right with his credentials below, Eddie Casey's signature at right with no credentials, Casey's signature at right, no copyright information at bottom card. There's at least four print runs that they did on this. And then he went on to further state, and I remember him doing this research in like 2007, 2008. I'm like, oh my gosh, because on the CU boards, you know, he was like, can everybody send me pictures of what the back of their cards look like? And I was like, this is pretty cool. I really tip my hat to people who dig into sets like this. But he went on to say, each card in the low series, 1 through 24, appeared to exist with two of the four available backs. Each card in the high number, 25 through 36, appears to only exist with back number one. And the first 24 cards, all but 13 and 21, have back one. And the first 24 cards, all but 15, 16, 19, 20, 23, have back two. And he goes on. I mean, that kind of reinforces how the sheet was laid out, 1 through 24. I'd love to contact Near Mint Mike, you know, Mike Thomas, and ask him. That's the one sheet he doesn't have. What it would have looked like. And the only reason is there are no miscuts of this card. You know, how I built what the 48 leaf set sheet looked like was by looking at miscut cards and going, oh, there's the adjacent card. And you begin to, you know, kind of extrapolate the information. For years, I was looking for miscut 35 Chickle cards, you know, and they're not grossly miscut enough where you can see the adjacent card, which is a shame. I'd love it, but so we know four print runs. We know that it was, you know, 1 through 24 are probably double print and 25 through 36 are single print. So how they're laid out on the sheet is not known, but, you know, I would imagine they were printed, like I said, the same way the 57 tops was, but we will never know until that unicorn 35 Chickle uncut sheet appears in a, you know, whatever. I hope, you know, hopefully it's one of the good option houses, not something with a confusing, you know, setup like Hunt.
Go back to two things that you mentioned before, the Tossie card. I'm looking back in my notes. I never saw one in person, believe it or not. It might have been the card at one of the Nationals. However, I never got to see it. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, I did not actually see my first high number of the Chickle set until a show in 1996. Now, that's not saying I saw ads for them and stuff like that, but actually seeing one with a high number on it was not until a show in 1996, a local show in Connecticut where a guy had a few Chickles there. I did not buy the high number because I thought it was too expensive. I don't know what he was charging, but he did have a couple low numbers in lesser condition. I know I picked them up from him. So that's just telling you the rarity of the set. And again, It also, and I know we talked about this in the past too, I've talked about this for years, how many card number 25 to 36 are actually still in existence today? Is it, again, we go around in a circle. Is it over 100? Is it under 100? Is it over 50? Is it under 50? Is it completely obscure that there's maybe 20 of them, 25? We don't know, you know, because we don't know how many raw cards are out there, and we don't know how many cards are hidden in collections we'll never hear about until the collector passes or whatever type of thing. So it's really a great set from a historical point of view, from an investigative point of view, from a wondering point of view, to collect and put together. And again, the demand for it is very, very high in my opinion, because there are a lot of advanced collectors and advanced card collectors who collect, let's say, pre-World War II stuff, and they collect baseball, they collect anything. They're putting pressure on it. The hardcore football collector, the advanced football collector is putting pressure on it. The individual team player and the individual college player collector is putting pressure on it. So it's almost like a perfect storm for this set. It's always, in my opinion, it's always been a perfect storm for the set. It's a great set to collect. And, you know, in a way, I feel bad I started and stopped it so many times, because I'm really of the belief at this stage of my collecting, I would be down to the Nagurski and probably one or two, and probably the Tossy card. I know I would have put together 1 to 24. I've owned the Rockne a couple times. I owned it one time in an SGC graded one. I owned the Raw one time. So I know I would have had 1 to 24 completed. I know I would have had some of the high numbers. And, it's a cool set. I really enjoy it.
Just to dig down a little bit on your population, you know, question, I have taken notes on that. There have been a total of 6,279 35 Chico cards graded. In comparison, there have been nearly triple that of 48 Leaf, 14,753. So they are rarer than their next football counterpart by a third, the 48 Leaf. And the swap of grading of this is pretty cool. Of the 6,279, there's been one PSA 10, which was, I said, to Phil Sorbo, 83 PSA 9s, one of those are the Nags, 602 PSA 8s. So slightly less than 10% of these cards are PSA, which, you know, for an 85-year-old set seems unreasonable to me. 825 PSA 7s, 975 6s, 983 5, 1,075 4s, 657 3, 596 2s, 421 PSA 1s. So you see the belly. Over half of the cards that have been graded are PSA 4, 5, and 6, which makes sense. That should be where they are.
Yes.
Which is curious. I wonder what that.
And I got to say this, looking at and collecting the raw card over the years, my best ungraded card was the original Ken Strong card I bought back in 1988. And that's one card at the end. I kept that card when I was selling them off. That was the one card I kept from each transition from collecting set 1 to 2 to 3. I always thought about just holding on to that card, but then I said, I just wanted to get rid of them, and that was it. But I kicked myself that one. That's the one, the original one I should have saved of any of them. But again, and you could really appreciate the history of it. You appreciate the beauty of the printing of it for that time period.
Yep.
And you can appreciate the incredible scarcity of that set, whether it's graded or whether it's raw. I mean, it's great. It's a great set.
Quick note I just noticed. I mentioned there are 6,279 grade. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Bob.
No, I was just going to say, you don't have any pop reports for SGC, right? We don't know how many are
could be
graded by them.
That's a good point, but.
And I
mentioned there are 6,200. Go ahead.
I wonder. I wouldn't doubt there was probably only a couple hundred, if at most, of SBC graded. I could be completely wrong.
Good point. Yeah, I didn't bother with that up. I apologize. But I mentioned there are 6,279 total graded, of which 602 are at PSA 8, which is nearly 10%. And I just noticed in the 48 leaf, there are 14,753, of which 905 are at PSA 8 in the 48 leaf, which is less than 5%. So, I mean, 10% of the 35 chickles are PSA 8, 5%, or you're right around 5 or 6% of 48 leafs are PSA 8. But we, you know, but I wrote an article on the doctoring of the 48 leaf set because it seemed so prolific to me. And yet as percentage of overall graded, that's pretty interesting.
Right. That's a good point. That's a really good point. And again, because they've been doctored so much, you know, what is legit and what's not. 35 chickles, as far as I'm concerned, is a very legitimate set in the conditions that they've graded, because I don't think a lot of them were tampered with. I really don't believe that maybe 1% were tampered with, or at the most. I don't know. I could be completely wrong, but it's a set where we find it in
we've seen quite a few
the grandfather's
at thin borders. PSA, the sole PSA 9 35 chickle, which we just discovered is owned by who is the baseball owner, the baseball team owner, the Diamondbacks. Anyways, but we just commented when the PSA 8.5 sold 3 years ago, I put a comparison up of the PSA 8.5 and the 9. Pretty obvious the 9 has some thin borders. So I would imagine the quality control of PSA wasn't as good as it was now, you know, back then. So you get a couple couple cards slipped through the 5 hole. But I just wanted to get into this set is one of my favorites because these are little pieces of artwork. And the Nagurski obviously is my favorite just because of the star power. But number two is, oddly enough, the Ernie Cadell card. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but he is holding the football, running right out to you, football tucked under his arm, head down, eyes glazing forward. I'm looking at it right now. And behind him is a Pittsburgh player laying on the ground next to a blocker. It's a good card. Yep. I don't know who Ernie Cadell is. I've never looked him up, but this card to me is what football's about. It's an action photo. He's running right at you. He's about to bounce right out of the card, and I dig it.
Correct. Nice card. Nice card.
Yeah. The others are
all right. We're running out of time. We got about a minute and a half. I just want to mention again, if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. All right, Joe, let's wrap it up. We've got 40 seconds to wrap things up.
Oh, great. Great to talk again. And thanks for picking this topic. I love this set, and I love to talk about it. And I really enjoy it.
I think it's significant to see for auction. It brought back a lot of memories. It was a nice auction to watch. I'm really hoping who won it is a collector, and he or she was, you know, working their collection for it, and it's a key for them, or it's a good type card for their collection. That's what I'm hoping. I just hope it's not going to, like you said, be skeptical about it. Get it popped, pop it out, wash it up and see if you get a 2 or 3 out of it. I don't think that's going to happen. I'm optimistic it's not.
All right. Yeah. We are literally out of time. Joe, good talking. And again, anybody has that uncut sheet or knows of it, please let us know. A historical piece. Football history. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another show. Take care.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman. a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network. Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.